ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Patricia Carvalis here. I'm the host of the Politics Now podcast, and I spend a lot of time talking to politicians, usually grilling them. But over summer, I want to introduce you to the people behind the politics.
Oh my goodness, how long have we got?
Political parties, if they're just seen as sort of custodians of political values or traditions, it's not enough.
You can find the interview series in the Politics Now podcast feed.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Awabakal and Gadigal people. TV stations in the 1960s really knew how to write a catchy jingle.
Oh, pack up your troubles and forget your cares. Pack up your family and head for the fair in Seattle.
In 1962, Seattle was hosting the World's Fair, an entire event dedicated to predicting what life would be like in the 21st century.
Welcome to the future and all the wonders of the 21st century in the greatest preview the world has ever seen.
Take away a head, look at tomorrow, just as if you were there.
The Century 21 Expo predicted an exciting future of monorails, space needles, and a spherical elevator called the Bubbleator, which featured a very spooky voiceover.
Please step to the rear of the sphere.
One of the exhibits was a full-scale model of a 21st century home, and, well, it's pretty much just an ordinary 1960s house, but everything is curved. Curved walls, curved tables and chairs, curved bed for some reason. Everything is very mid-century modern. My dad would love it. Even the roof had a kind of Timu Sydney Opera House design. So they liked things big and curvy, fair enough. But a few years later, a similar exhibition in San Francisco took a very different approach.
This kitchen of tomorrow, for example, which is about to make all Australian housewives positively sick with envy.
The kitchen of tomorrow looked like a cube with a circular table in the middle, but the walls were made of various moving panels, which would extend, retract, or flip to reveal all the appliances and surfaces needed for food preparation. But the thing is, what they never talked about in any of the predictions was the eye-watering price tag of these future homes. Fast forward to now, and these kitchen oracles got a few things wrong. Homes aren't particularly curved, and there certainly aren't secret dishwashers hidden in dining tables. Here in Australia, though, we are in the middle of a crippling, decades-long housing affordability crisis with no end in sight. But this is a crisis that's actually been on the horizon for decades, and along the way there have been serious attempts to fix it. So how did it go so wrong? I'm Matt Bevan. And from If You're Listening, this is Black Swans, a series about how, despite our best efforts, predicting the future is almost impossible. This episode is about the great Australian pastime, talking about housing. And we've been partaking in this pastime for a while. We know this because we found an incredible buried treasure of letters addressed to us, sent by prominent Adelaideans, writing in the year 1959 as part of an ABC project called Letters to the Unborn. And they too spoke a lot about housing.
I assume housing flats have gone on diminishing, getting smaller and less complicated every year. Do you really live in a thing not much bigger than a couple of our phone boxes? Is this personal box really convertible, including aroma, to a kitchen or a bedroom or a bathroom according to your need of the moment and your own thought, selection of the fixtures, furnishings and gadgets that you want?
Not quite. I mean, I have a couch that can turn into a bed when relatives are over, but that's pretty much it. Now, even if housing affordability wasn't being discussed as much in the 50s, changing market trends were certainly a hot topic.
When we were young, people were often born in the same house that their great-great-grandparents had been born in. As we are now, families are selling off old homes right and left. People use their homes as wives use their hats.
Home ownership was very important, people were often married very young and keen to start families, so expected to be able to buy a home to fit them all in.
As a younger fellow, home was always very important to me as a teenager, and later on as I became engaged to the girl next door, and I hope that the home will hold exactly the same needs in the heart of my children as it held for me as I grew up.
But where were all these families with so many kids going to live? In the 1950s, nearly half of Australia's population lived in its four largest cities, and that number was growing every year as more and more jobs shifted into Sydney, Melbourne, and Brisbane.
And so today, the people of our towns have to put up with the discomforts of unplanned, overcrowded cities. Cities which have outgrown themselves.
Those cities weren't even close to being ready for that amount of growth. Here's Ray Dufty-Jones, a professor of urban planning at the University of Sydney.
There'd been two depressions, a major pandemic and two world wars to stifle building development at that time. And suddenly both state and federal governments were investing in a big way when it came to housing in an attempt to fill a massive deficit in housing supply at that time.
Poor town planning meant that living conditions for a lot of people were not ideal.
Thousands are forced to live in cramped and sombre houses in our boundless sunny land.
So, how come this is still a problem? Well, in the 1950s, the debate was over whether cities should expand upwards or outwards, high-rise apartments or even more sprawling suburbs. Alex Ramsey, one of our letter writers, was convinced that by now we would have settled that debate.
I'm glad to see that you're no longer suggesting that the ordinary man and wife with his young family should live an unnatural life in a concrete box on the 10th floor of an apartment building near the centre of a city. You've done with that.
Yep, all done. No families in apartments here. The fear of families living in concrete boxes en masse was so strong that some cities were attempting to tackle the housing supply issue before it became a bigger problem. One of those cities was Adelaide. At the end of World War II, Adelaide was in the middle of a battle against Brisbane for the title of Australia's third largest city. That implies it was a big city, though. It was not. Its population was about 380,000, or smaller than the Sunshine Coast is today.
Adelaide, built on a site chosen and surveyed by Colonel Light 112 years ago, is now a garden city with broad streets and city squares.
The tightly packed CBD was surrounded by parklands and a small ring of suburbs. Turning it into something more than that would be difficult. Adelaide is a very long way from anywhere in particular. Adelaideans like historian Susan Marsden tend to agree.
I have a friend who is an environmental lawyer. He once said to me, they made a terrible mistake putting Adelaide here, that it should have been declared a national park right from the start. And, you know, we're on the margins of a desert for a start. I mean, we've done pretty well considering.
But the Premier at the time, Sir Thomas Playford, was determined to attract large industries to his state.
South Australia, before the war, an agricultural outpost, was now industrially on the map. Sir Thomas Playford came along and spearheaded the boom.
Sir Thomas, who ended up being the Premier for nearly 30 years, was a bit of a force to be reckoned with.
Assisted by favourable decentralisation policies from Canberra and incentives offered to them by Playford, the manufacturers headed west.
One of the key promises he made to manufacturers was that if they moved their business to South Australia, they would be able to pay workers lower wages. But that created a paradox. More jobs in South Australia means more people will want to move there.
In the late 40s, 50s and early 60s, population grew here at a faster rate than anywhere else in the country.
More people wanting to live in the city drives up house prices, which will mean people want higher wages, and you're back to square one. Playford's solution, according to Professor Ray Dufty-Jones, was to build as many homes as humanly possible.
In South Australia, it was a really unique approach. They saw housing as a source of revitalising their state economy. And so the Premier at that time had decided that industry and manufacturing was the way forward for South Australia. And so housing and affordable housing for workers was key to that.
And it was important that those new houses were going to comply with the Australian dream.
It wasn't just about producing good quality housing, but also a good quality citizen. So they needed to be moral, devoted to democratic ideals and not seduced by socialism. And so for that reason, the standalone home with a garden was considered to produce that kind of citizen.
Only commies live in apartments. To realise his utopian capitalist vision, Playford created the South Australian Housing Trust and put Alex Ramsey, our letter writer from earlier, in charge. Ramsey even spoke about the trials of town planning in his letter.
Somebody well before your time, my dear descendant, decided that the main question was the location of work, because this always provided the reason for people living in one place. As soon as this was realised, factories and offices were located so that the houses of those who worked in them could be built as close as possible.
So you spread out the factories and offices over a large area and build homes so people who work there can live nearby. This was, in fact, Alex Ramsey's life's work. It was the purpose of the entire South Australian Housing Trust. Susan Marsden has spent a lot of time looking into Ramsey's work.
So the intention, very focused, was to build good, cheap worker housing and therefore reduce the costs of labour in South Australia and draw industrial development to the state, which worked very well.
And Ramsey's magnum opus was building a new town called Elizabeth.
Elizabeth, South Australia. To you perhaps just a name, but to us here in South Australia, a city, the newest planned city in the Commonwealth of Australia.
Elizabeth was a city built by the Housing Trust outside the state capital of Adelaide, intended to decentralise jobs and create more affordable housing options for young families.
17 miles north of Adelaide, Elizabeth is established on the main northern highway, only half an hour by road or rail service to Adelaide, designed on a vast scale, 10 suburbs and 3 industrial areas each radiate out from a large town centre.
This is not how cities are usually built. Generally, they grow around some sort of a resource or a transportation hub. Industries grow, creating jobs and attracting population growth. They're not artificially planted somewhere just because the land is cheap. But by the time Alex Ramsey was writing his letter in 1959, the city had reached a population of around 15,000, and he expected that it would grow even larger.
A town with a target, a city of 50,000 people by the late 1960s.
The Trust had built 4,000 homes in 47 different designs, all of which were available to buy from the Elizabeth Information Centre. Take a listen to this promotional film produced by the Housing Trust.
This is attractive, Bob. I like the porch idea. How about this one?
But I think this is perhaps more in my style.
They've all got nice big windows, haven't they?
Well, that paid actor sounds quite pleased, but it's important to remember that at the time, the concept of a nice house was quite different to today. Demographer Bernard Salt's parents brought him up in a similar type of house to the ones in Elizabeth.
They were absolutely over the moon at being awarded or given access to a Victorian Housing Commission house. They thought all their Christmases had come at once, of course. 3 bedrooms, 1 bathroom, outside toilet, or lavatory, as it was called. A quarter acre block, 1,000 square metres. Mum and Dad, 6 kids in our household, so bunk beds, the whole shebang. And no dining room. You would have meals around the kitchen table, of course.
8 people sharing 3 bedrooms and 1 bathroom. Seems like more of an Australian nightmare than an Australian dream, but it was better than an apartment.
Well, I don't think we'll have any trouble finding a really nice home in Elizabeth.
And according to historian Susan Marsden, this is what Elizabeth promised to provide.
So 1,000 houses a year they were constructing at Elizabeth. So that did have a depressing, if that's the right word, effect on housing prices.
Alex Ramsey's plan wasn't just to dump a bunch of houses out in the middle of nowhere and hope that people would move in. He wanted the city to be self-sufficient.
They got a lot of powers from the government to build factories, to build halls, to build schools and neighbourhood centres and so on. By the 1960s, there were 23 churches there, 19 factories.
Ramsey intended to design Elizabeth like a one-stop shop for everything a growing community could need, which they really hammer home in this promotional video.
Now, jobs, what's the employment situation like? Are there any big firms close by?
I thought you'd ask that.
Yes, because it was in the promotional film's script.
You'll find that in Elizabeth, the factory areas have been planned close enough to the houses to be convenient, but of course, not too close.
Employment opportunities were looking good. At the time, car manufacturer Holden was in the process of moving its massive factory to Elizabeth.
With a modern, well-equipped factory in very pleasant surroundings.
South Australia attracted Holden to Elizabeth with the offer of cheap land and power, along with a willing workforce paid a modest wage, but given subsidised housing.
Electronics, packaging and tractor manufacturers followed suit. All of that sounds great. There was also a fireworks factory and an asbestos pipes factory, which sounds a little bit less great, but Premier Playford was thrilled.
Large factories have been established. A very large city indeed has grown up. Population of some 25,000 people. A very pleasant place to live in has been established. I believe that the people of Elizabeth are very happy people indeed.
On paper, Elizabeth looked like it ticked every box. Even the town's namesake, Queen Elizabeth II, visited and agreed.
I'm delighted to find that Elizabeth has grown into such an attractive and thriving community.
And while Premier Playford got most of the credit for the success of Elizabeth, he insisted that the credit belonged to his housing trust boss.
There is no one who was more responsible for the successful establishment of Elizabeth than Mr. Alec Ramsay. There was no greater friend of Elizabeth than Mr. Alec Ramsay.
Under Alex Ramsay, South Australia had the highest rate of housing construction per capita in the country. Cities like Elizabeth were keeping the Australian dream alive. And it wasn't just Elizabeth. There were similar satellite cities in development around every major Australian city.
It's all part of the development of Campbelltown as a satellite city. Campbelltown is 55 minutes by electric train from Sydney.
This will be West Melton, Melbourne's first planned satellite city, a city in which everything has been thought of in advance.
But would building these satellite cities work? Well, everyone certainly hoped so. After all, something needed to be done about housing supply. Australia was experiencing an unprecedented population boom. The baby boom was well underway, and tens of thousands of migrants were arriving every year.
And people from many different lands have made a new life in Elizabeth. After all, life goes on in much the same way here as it does in other countries.
Although when they say many different lands, they really only mean one in particular.
There's an English family in this street. They've made a good job of their home and garden too.
Nearly 50% of the population of Elizabeth were English immigrants. That Mark Pills pointed out, it was the highest concentration of ethnic people in Australia at the time.
Those that weren't English were often Scottish.
I was born in Glasgow, but I grew up in Elizabeth, which is a satellite city outside of Adelaide.
You might not recognise that voice when he's not screaming at the top of his lungs, but that's Jimmy Barnes.
And they sort of tended to stick a lot of the immigrants there in the 60s when they brought them over for 10 quid. So it was a fairly sort of rough and ready sort of joint.
At the time our letters were being written, Australia's population was officially 10,060,003. Except it wasn't. Population counts at the time were always branded with the disclaimer, quote, excluding full-blood Aboriginals. Of the people we could be bothered counting, less than 1% were born somewhere other than Australia, New Zealand, or Europe. For context, it's 24% now. Australia was, constitutionally, and by force of bipartisan government policy, a racist country. The immigration system operated under the White Australia policy, which enjoyed bipartisan support in Parliament. Here's Arthur Caldwell, the former Minister for Immigration, speaking about why he thought it was a good idea.
It's within the compass of four generations that this country has been made. Our tough people helped to tame a continent, and we are trying to do that too. We have no bitterness and no resentment against other people, but we can't be expected to solve the overpopulation problems of the world.
Our letter writers felt pretty strongly about the burden of increasing population. We explored that in the first episode of this series, but some of them actually referenced the White Australia policy directly.
I know I would like Australia to stay white in an overwhelmingly coloured world. I may be offending you in saying this.
You may very well be. They were concerned that invasion from non-white countries would destroy Australia's national characteristics.
Not that they're all good characteristics, good Lord, no. But they are our own. They mean a good deal to us now, and he thinks that they'll mean even more to us in the years to come when every country will be fighting to keep its beliefs, its culture, its way of life from being drowned in a uniform sea.
Of course, by your time, there will be little of the Australiana as we know it.
Our northern neighbours will have absorbed us long ago, peacefully, if not by other means.
Among our letter writers, there were several who were opposed to the White Australia policy, but even they had a very 1959 way of talking about it.
The younger generation, at least, has begun to accept the fact that black, brown or yellow may be as good as or better than white.
How absurd this must seem to you, distant reader, for I suspect that you're a half-breed of wonderfully mixed inheritance, perhaps rather like the fine people who live in the Philippines.
But for now, the fine people being brought to Elizabeth were white. The question is, was this grand idea to build a satellite town successful? Our historian Susan Marsden thinks that it was initially.
Yes, I think it was. It drew thousands of people to South Australia. It drew factories to South Australia, or helped underpin factory, industrial and commercial development.
She does have some important caveats, though.
Elizabeth was very much a man's industrial town in that sense. So it was a very gendered as well as class created town, basically. And that was very deliberately intended. And it was a great deal of prejudice, really, formal prejudice against married women working.
This didn't sit well with the migrants flooding into Elizabeth, who had come from a far more progressive place.
English women were much more accustomed to work outside the home at that point than Australian women.
But there were no jobs in Elizabeth for women. They'd have to travel to Adelaide. But the two cities weren't well connected by public transport, and driving was tricky.
They assumed that women wouldn't actually need cars.
So it became a company town, where everyone living there relied on a small number of large, foreign-owned factories for their income, which worked well until it didn't.
No matter how successful a state instrumentality or even a national government is, as we all know, if international capital decides it doesn't want to invest anymore, it doesn't. Simple as that.
Like hundreds of other Western industrial towns, when investment dried up, the jobs started to disappear and the middle-class families started to leave town.
The young in particular seemed to be going to places like Sydney, which, with its phenomenal growth in recent years, is absorbing and even taking away more and more of the service industries.
Alex Ramsey died in 1978, and his replacements were less aspirational in their town planning. They started using Elizabeth as a place to house low-income families.
What that meant was that you had increasing rates of unemployed living at Elizabeth.
Elizabeth boasts the highest unemployment rate in the nation at 21.5%.
And so Elizabeth therefore became much more of a, it's a phrase that gets bandied about, more of a ghetto of with people who are really struggling.
This is an area where you've got third-generation families where nobody's ever worked.
The final blow was when the Holden factory, which had brought so many jobs to Elizabeth, closed completely in 2013.
This is really a very disadvantaged area to begin with. It's got real challenges, and this has just dealt another significant blow.
As Australia entered the global free market, areas like Elizabeth were left behind.
As tariff barriers that protected manufacturing were gradually pulled down, Elizabeth has morphed from workers' housing to welfare housing to wasted housing.
By 2025, the city was largely absorbed by the Adelaide urban sprawl, so Elizabeth isn't really a separate city anymore. It's one of the most disadvantaged parts of Australia these days. Crime rates are high, school completion rates are low, and sadly, this situation in Elizabeth isn't unique. Most attempts to plant new communities on the peripheries of large cities have generally failed. At best, they've become commuter suburbs, where most of the population must travel vast distances to get to their jobs in central hubs. At worst, they become centres of high unemployment that can feel very hard to escape. These days, if you were to visualise the Australian population as 100 people, 20 of them would live in Sydney, 20 in Melbourne, 10 in Brisbane, 9 in Perth, 5 in Adelaide, 3 in the Gold Coast, 2 in Newcastle, the Sunshine Coast and Canberra, 1 in Hobart, Darwin, Cairns, Geelong, Toowoomba, Townsville and Wollongong. The other 20 people, well, I guess we're just going to have to chop them up and scatter their organs across the rest of the country. Sad, yes, but statistics is a dangerous game. To accommodate those non-dissected people, big cities began to abandon the Australian dream in the late 80s.
Federal Housing Minister Peter Staples says our cities are sprawling and it's time to get rid of the traditional Australian concept of the quarter-acre block.
cities, instead of spreading out across the landscape into the across the horizon, effectively, we've got to start developing more medium density housing.
Medium density housing, so smaller properties and smaller homes. Perhaps the future really was that cube kitchen with the retractable dishwasher. Or, as experts like Phil Riven were predicting in the early 90s, maybe no kitchen at all.
Really what we're on about for the next 50 years is getting families to outsource all the services, which means that you don't make goods at home and you don't do any services at home either.
You don't cook?
You sure don't cook. I think that's on the way to being a museum piece in a home. Because very clearly, with two income earning families, the idea of going home to do a third and a fourth job for husband and wife just isn't on.
It turns out we just cop it. Phil Riven spent the following decade or so making predictions that conditions for young families were going to improve.
Residential real estate prices going through the roof the way they are. Do you see an end to that?
Yes, I do. First of all, the end of the price rises, I certainly do. I mean, you've now got a situation where in Sydney you're paying nine times an annual male's earnings to get into a house.
Nine times, eh? Well, let me just see where that's up to now. Yeah, it's 14 times now.
It's obviously ridiculous, and we will see a fall of about 15 to 20% at the top end of housing, and that'll make it a bit more affordable again for the first home buyer.
I think I need a beer, to be honest with you. I'll check if I've got one in my combined fridge oven.
But the more interesting thing, I think, George, is that the younger people won't want home ownership in the same way that my generation did.
Oh boy. Well, the statistics would tell you that home ownership has become a lot less common. Here's economist Shane Oliver.
Home ownership, in fact, peaked in the mid-1960s at around 73%. So in other words, 73% of Australians were living in a home that they or their family owned. Of course, since then, there's been a dramatic decline. It's now down to around 63%. But I think the basic driver is a lack of supply relative to underlying demand for housing.
This series is called Black Swans, and so I've been looking for black swans that caused predictions of the past to be wrong. In this case, people expected that someone would ensure that Australians would be able to live in affordable houses. The unexpected thing was...
government has not responded appropriately.
All Australians want to be able to afford to live somewhere nice without having to travel for hours every day to get to work. But millions of Australians, many of whom are in couples where both partners have good, well-paying jobs, still can't afford to buy a home. And for the last few decades at least, governments haven't really tried all that hard to help them.
As high house prices have become more and more embedded in the system, there becomes a political dynamic that sees that accentuated. Because don't forget, you've still got around just below two-thirds of Australians either own their own house or are paying it off. They don't really want to see house prices fall. And this increasingly includes millennials. It's not just baby boomers like me and Gen X, but it's increasingly millennials.
Wait, hang on. Am I part of the problem here?
So as they get into the property market, they've paid those inflated prices. The last thing they want to see is a big fall in prices.
You know what? He's right. Ignore everything I've said here. That's my equity and you can't have it.
So consequently, politicians have not been as focused, perhaps, on addressing the issue as they should be. And we've seen this affordability crisis continue and, in fact, get worse and worse as the years go by.
During the pandemic, I moved to a regional city from a capital city because I could no longer afford to live there. Since then, I've mostly worked from home. And for a while, I truly thought that people working from home en masse would finally allow that decentralisation we've been looking for all this time. But now there's a strong push to wind that back.
We've also required that all federal employees must once again show up to work in person like the rest of us.
People refusing to go back to work in Canberra is not acceptable.
Shane Oliver thinks that in professions that allow it, a mix of remote and in-office work is the solution, and that infrastructure investment can make that a reality.
Look, I know there has been a push to come back to the office, and there's good cultural reasons for that, and I can understand that, but I think you've got to get the balance right here. It would be easier to decentralise, and if we had the infrastructure, you could still live in the Blue Mountains or even at Orange. If you had a very fast train that would get you back to the city for your one day a week, that would probably work.
But look, if the government isn't going to introduce policy to make houses more affordable, they could at least make it easier and faster to get around. What if you could live in one city and be quickly transported to another one for work? Our letter writers of 1959 assumed that by now we would have that all sorted out.
You all commute daily and hourly so fast through space in your private flying saucers, spaceships, time and space equalizers, or whatever you may call them.
And yet we don't. In fact, we travel at almost the exact same speed we did in 1959. Why is that? We'll look into it next on Black Swans. This special series of If You're Listening was written by me, Matt Bevan. It was produced by Adair Shepherd, Caroline Gates, Pat Sunderland and Jess O'Callaghan. Supervising producer is Cara Jensen-McKinnon. Now, I know I just said that we'll be talking about travel speed next, and that's true. That is what we will be talking about on our next Thursday episode. On Tuesday, though, we're going to delve more into the story of Alex Ramsey, because the stories behind the creation of Elizabeth and what he had to do to acquire the land are wild. Now, I know that land acquisition anecdotes don't sound riveting, but you'll just have to trust me. I'll catch you next week.